Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Outcasts with me, Powder Monkey Tim Downey, and Cabin Boy David Berry. This is the show that sets sail on the good ship Outlander for lands unknown and treasures unequaled, guided only by the heavenly bodies glittering in the inky firmament above us. And what a heavenly body we have for you today. Director and all-round good egg, he has worked on such productions as Poldark, Harry Potter, The Halcyon, to name but a few, and of course Outlander. He is the brilliant Stephen Wolfenden. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you could grace our decks as we sail off into the Outlander trip of the unknown.
Tim, no one understands what you're saying right now. I need a translation.
Isn't it? It's good, though.
It is very good.
I wanted to paint a glorious picture that nobody understood.
You did.
But people felt that they did. That was my onus, I felt on that.
You succeeded marvelously.
Thank you.
Marvelously.
Wonderful. Good. Well, as is always with our show, we are going to pick a show where our guest has picked a scene for us. It's a very good scene. I'm very excited by this scene because this was a scene I can remember seeing going, this is a fun scene. This is a scene I would have liked to have been a part of, and it's from episode one. A tiny bit of background before we leap in is this is the drunk scene. This is the drinking game scene. Is that right?
It's the drinking game scene, sort of in the middle of the wedding night's festivities, yes.
Fabulous, fabulous. Now, before we leap in, we usually like to align parts, see who would like to read what. So I think we'd say that I will give you my my JQM, like a nice sort of heavy Welsh. So that's always going to be fun to hear. And I may, in fact, I think we said I may even do a little bit of Lord John Grey, just to really mix that up and to show you my range.
You insisted upon that, Tim. Let's be honest now.
I don't think people need to peek behind the curtain this early, David. I think we just need to just focus.
I think they should know how it came about. Threats of death.
I strong-armed my way into this, Stephen. I said, I'm doing it. Much like, you know, much like I would. So I will take John Quincy and Lord John Grey. Mr. David Berry will give us, we're saying his Fergus? Did we say that?
Yeah, I'm going to give you Fergus and I'm going to give you Marsley.
Fantastic.
But this is up for discussion because I would really like to ask Stephen if there's any character, even Lord John Grey, that you would like to play. I will happily give that opportunity to you. I understand at one point you had ambitions of being an actor. This could be your big opportunity here. So I'll open the floor to you, Stephen.
Well, I'd love to give the Morton line a go.
It's yours. It's yours.
Very modest. Very modest.
I'm told that one of the training exercises for getting your Scottish accent, there's a key phrase. Now, there's something about Kawasaki, I think.
There is. That's for when you're doing Newcastle.
It's Newcastle, Kawasaki. That's right.
And, it's your buzzword to get in, yeah.
And so, and I heard that on a show that you'd done, and I thought that there was a phrase, there's been a murder in Aberdeen, is a really good way of getting into a Scottish accent, which is, there's been a murder in Aberdeen.
Wow. Chilling. Chilling. Yes, I think that's the word for me, is that the Scots say murder in a totally unique way. That's the word to get in. I'm looking out for that now.
Richard used to tell me, and it would amuse me immensely, that, well, he'd string a bunch of words together. Let me see if I can do this. Purple burglar alarm. Do you understand anything of what I just said?
No.
Something about a burglar alarm?
Yeah, purple burglar alarm.
Purple burglar alarm.
Yeah, apparently if you string those words together, you'll sound really Scottish.
So we could go, there's been a murder in Aberdeen and it set off the purple burglar alarm.
Amazing.
Perfect. And you're in and we are running and sound and action. And I think that's it. That's how we find this.
Well, Tim, should we also give Stephen the benefit of reading the big print, seeing as he is the director?
Yes, 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 we absolutely should.
I would feel very strange if he wasn't directing me in some way, whether through a big print or just his direction. And if you do, Stephen, at any point want to jump in and direct me, Tim, I want to speak for you, but if you want to direct me, Stephen, I'm more than happy to do it.
I would love nothing more. So, yes. Anytime you want to leap in, please feel free. But I think first off is when you first see a scene like this, Stephen, do you approach this by going, oh God, this is going to take forever? Or is this a scene you get excited by? Would you look at this and go, oh, this is, yes, okay, I know exactly how I'm going to do this. I know how I'm going to approach this.
This is a scene that jumped off the page and you thought, oh, this is a bit of a gift because you know the cast involved, you know the characters involved. And you know that there'll be a certain amount of energy to harness, to encourage, to grab hold of. And so it was one I was really, really looking forward to. And strangely, it happened on the last night of our wedding shoot. So it was virtually the last thing that we did. It was on the 24th of April, 2019. And we were filming until 3:30 in the morning. So... And we'd been doing the wedding for about 7 days and nights. We were on split days. We'd been going to bed at 5-6 o'clock in the morning the nights before, and we had to get out of there by 3:30 in the morning. So we only had a certain amount of night time to do it. And this session would have taken about 3.5 hours. But it jumps off the page. All the characters are having fun. And my role is to encourage that energy and also to find the energy of the background. One of the big things with scenes like this is whatever cast you've got doing the most wonderful things, if the background, if the supporting artists are not connected to the scene, connected to the characters, if they don't understand what's going on, then it can fall really flat. So I'm a big one. The director has to be a chameleon of many different characters, and you have to sort of step out of your comfort zone and really become a ringmaster with the first assistant director. But you have to really, there's 140 people in costume on that, on that night, and you have to harness that energy.
And how much rehearsal do you have for a scene like this?
Well. This is the ongoing battle of the schedule and what you can actually physically achieve for rehearsal. But I would say we probably had, with the cast on set, about 20 minutes to half an hour tops rehearsing. And then
to do that
whole scene and
do the whole scene,
and then just talk about how we're going to shoot it. And then we would be bringing all the supporting artists on, and then we'd be shooting within the hour of first rehearsing.
God.
Definitely. If not, you will never make a schedule like this.
That's absolutely true. I was there. I remember it.
Yeah.
Although I do remember that we did have an additional rehearsal just after the read-through. It's something that you very seldom get on Outlander. And I was very happy that you called for that. A lot of directors don't always do that. But you know the mettle of a director when they do ask for that, because you know that they've probably had to insist upon it or request it, especially in this schedule. It's very hectic. So we had a good idea of what we were getting ourselves into before we had that very limited time on that set on that evening.
Yeah, that's a rare play that you can make. And it just so happened that after the read through, all the people were in the right place. And it,
I'd come from Australia just to do the rehearsal.
Yeah.
How committed I am.
Without that rehearsal after the read through, it would have cost us another half an hour on the night. We wouldn't have got half the coverage. We wouldn't have got lots of other little montage-y bits that we also shot that night. So, yes, it was a good memory as well, because it also, helped create the company vibe before we actually got on set.
I'm so pleased you said that, Stephen, about the montage-y bits, because one of those scenes that I think a lot of people mentioned to me that was not scripted was the one where John Quincy Myers and Lord John and who else is on that log?
It was John Tarsi.
That was your brainchild. That was like, how about we get a scene with the three of you and John's at the fire? I remember that being impromptu, and having the opportunity to do that may not have happened. Did we not have the rehearsal for this particular scene? Am I correct in thinking that?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's so much time you can make for yourself in pre-production with a good sort of set of I wrote down the seven P's, which are a famous
P's.
The seven P's in the military world are the five P's, or proper planning and preparation prevents piss poor performance.
Yes. And Peter Piper picked a pebble.
It's one of those as well. But yeah, by getting yourself grabbing any time you can with the cast to rehearse in advance buys you time further down the line. It also sets people at ease. It also sets their minds working, and then they come back to the set on the night with even more better ideas and more excitement about what they've got to achieve. And the little montage-y bit was in the script. There were a series of very sort of nebulous, non-specific establishes and little montage-y moments. And I said to Patrick, first AD, and Matt Roberts, the showrunner, I said, if we can get any characters in these, I want to just keep hold of people and grab the people that we know. If we see the people we know having fun, it's going to make more sense to people. And the whole John Quincy Myers thing just happened. It was 3:28 in the morning. I think we did two takes.
That's right.
You cracked up on take one going, really? And then you laughed, and then you went, yeah, no, this is funny. And then second time you went down.
I remember it was raining, and
it was.
And you said, we don't even know if we can get this shot. Look, can we just go for it? You put the camera on a slider on a track, and then we did it. And it may never have happened, but you got that moment of gold that really sung in that episode and really got the attention of people. Got a very great response in that. These are the things that, you know, we can talk about later, but thinking on the fly and being able to be adaptable is probably one of the really great assets of, probably not in those P's that you were talking about, padaptable or thinking on the fly. But I think that's probably something that you need as a director.
So here we are. We are scene 12 on episode one. Stephen, you're taking the stage directions. Would you like to lead us in?
Scene 12, exterior Fraser's Ridge, the big house. Meanwhile, as per Jamie's instructions, John Gray has found a table laden with beverages of all kinds, bottles and tankards galore. Near it, keen to take advantage of the free-flowing alcohol, Fergus, John Quincy Myers, Isaiah Morton and others are currently playing a drinking game which involves drunkenly reciting tongue twisters. Master Lee is also playing. The game involves throwing around a leather hip flask like a ball at random. The person who catches it must recite a tongue twister without hesitating too long or making a mistake, thereby winning the approbation of the crowd or facing a forfeit. One of the shots of whiskey is lined up on the table. Once a tongue twister is repeated successfully, a new one must be proposed. It's Isaiah's turn. He's struggling to think of anything under the mounting pressure as John Quincy Myers times him with a small hourglass.
Right, now, prepare yourselves. Come on, Morton. Time waits for no man. That is a quality. I don't know where he's from. That is a quality. Well, I know where Carl's from, but that is a quality accent, and one that if you were to do in the valleys, they would just think you are a native. Come on, Morton. Time waits for no man.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
I mean, glorious.
That was with a bit of pirate. Added pirate.
I think the pirate lifted it. Again, we had rehearsal. We had moments to look at it, moments to go through it. And I think just that little, oh, I know, I'll bring in. I think it was actually the introduction of, say, we're on the Outlander boat, has fed in to creating a more rounded Morton, which I think is fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
The onlookers cheer. Slanty. Relieved to have avoided the forfeit, Isaiah takes a zip from the flask, then throws it at Fergus, who panicking struggles.
Here we go.
Oh, God.
Prepare yourself, please, Stephen. This is going to be something quite wonderful.
Peter Piper picked a mouth. That was really bad.
Loved every second.
Move on, please. Quick as we can.
John Quincy Myers is chanting.
All right, here we go. Forfeit! Forfeit!
Fergus is forced down a shot of whiskey. Fergus throws the flask to Marcelly, who catches it.
Okay. Well, I'm having some thoughts about Marcelly. I'm having some doubts about my Scottish accent and purple burglar alarm. So she's going to be Australian, okay? Oh, my mind is a blank.
You'd have had more luck in French, my love.
She's just Australian. She gets it upside down. I'm sorry.
You've just decided, I've cut that. I've cut take those two, lines. They're two. Not doing it for me.
Yep. I see you've worked with Australians before.
I have worked with Australians before. My Melbourne housewife accent there, I think, is really going quite well.
It was really quite good.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to try and imitate that.
Go for it.
You'd have more luck in French, my love. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
Beautiful.
There are cheers. She's got it right now. She flips Myers flips the sand glass. Okay. Try another one.
Quickly, Mistress Fraser, else you'll face a forfeit.
Oh, my mind is a blank.
She struggles. She plays the crowd.
Oh, heavens, tis maybe a wee bit vulgar for a lady. May the Lord forgive me. There is an old pheasant, and he's not too pleasant, and though I'm not a pheasant plucker, I'll be plucking pheasants till the pheasant plucking's done. Jesus, that's hard to say.
This is the need of rehearsal. This is why you desperately need rehearsal.
I'd definitely be asking for another take on that one, please.
Can you imagine it if I had done it in a Scottish accent? I'd be here all night.
It would just be like,
that's wonderful. That's full pirate. That's not Scottish. We're going
full
pirate.
I've gone full pirate. Full Bluebeard. Right. Oh, Fergus. You're Fergus. Back to David again. It's the David show.
Who taught you that? My ma. I'm sure she'd be very proud.
Fergus kisses Marcelly, and in her excitement as a success, Marcelly takes a quick swig from the flask and throws it carelessly. It is caught by an unsuspecting and rather mortified John Grey. In spite of this, with his honour at stake, he tries to salvage his gentlemanly reputation as best he can. He just can't bring himself to try this particular tongue twister in public, especially sober.
Oh, I'm a little bit nervous, Tim. I'm a little bit nervous because I have a confession.
Ooh.
And I feel like now's a good time to tell you.
Let's do it.
I have always felt you might potentially make a better John Grey.
That is outrageous. That is outrageous, and I will not hear that.
I am a little bit nervous that you're about to read it and everyone's going to agree with me, but go ahead. I'm prepared to listen to you. I will bow down to you. Hey. Please don't make it too good. I'd like to keep my job.
I'll try not to make it too good. I'll try my best on that. Right.
And this is new information, because most of this speech did not make the cut due to...
No. Didn't make the cut.
Due to what, Stephen, actually? That's a question I've been dying to ask you.
Due to momentum and the humour was there just with the one line that you did say. And it was part of a montage, and anything that puts the brakes on too much was nipped out.
You see, I've always had a problem
with momentum.
They've been telling me that in drum school.
The edit process is something to talk about later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is what the public have missed. Here we go.
So the crowd goes silent. It's Lord John Grey enigmatically receiving the gift of having to make a speech in public. Mm-hmm. Cue.
I must admit, I'm doing a bit Hugh Grant, but I think it's working.
It's really good.
I must admit, it's with deep regret, in fact, that I must tell you that I've never had the pleasure of... I've never plucked a pheasant in all my life. Oh.
There's still silence. People are looking at each
still
other.
Still silent. But some Shakespeare is dead. Anyone? With bloody, blameful blade, he bravely broached his boiling bloody breast. Yeah? Been someone I dream.
Nobody nobody on Fraser's Ridge has ever heard anything so beautiful, so crazy, such poetry. He holds the room. they just don't know how to react. And then John Quincy Myers just says, nah, forfeit.
My throat's drying out. Who's next? End scene. We move on. Glorious. I think a whole new take and a whole new... We could film that again, almost. I think that is fabulous. thank you. Thank you for that.
Wow.
I was going to ask, as we were reading it, obviously you approached the idea. Obviously, things change throughout the process. When you first sit down, you read that scene. You'll have an idea of how you want people to be and where you want people to be. Then you'll go to the read-through. And does it change again? Does that directorial hat, does that go, actually, we need to cover it more this particular way? And then does it change again once you get on set with the limitations that are either of time or actor or space? So is it an ever-evolving thing? Is it a very organic thing? Or is it quite set when you do actually kind of go, right, the cameras then start rolling?
It's a number of things. It's a number of things. The first thing to say about... read-throughs are so important. The table read is so important.
It's so funny you say that because actors are thinking just the opposite half the time.
I know.
We haven't slept the night before, probably had a bit to drink, and it's, oh, it's just a read-through. We'll come in, we'll read. And it's funny how you're coming at it the complete opposite direction. But please, I want to hear, why is it so important?
And I've got some gold dust for you, and,
please.
And especially for younger cast members, the read through is the first time that everybody's in the room together. Often at the read through, you will have, especially on block one, you will have executives of varying levels that won't attend all the other read throughs, but they are there. They've travelled up from America, from London or whatever. There's a good tier of industry bigwigs who are listening in on this. Sometimes read-throughs are recorded and then sent to executives who can't be there. My advice to younger cast members in the read-through and the older cast members in the read-through, but not if you already own your part, but executives who hear interest and gold dust and energy in a read-through will commission more scenes with those characters. They will say, oh, she sounded really good. Make sure she's in another couple of scenes. Oh, wasn't he funny? Oh, try and put him in a scene with those. Those things really happen. And especially for young people, you know, on their first or second jobs, or only got four scenes in an episode, they might be able to get five or six scenes. Or further on down the line, the writers, as a series is evolving and the episodes are being written as we go along, there'll be more weight given to people who are impressing. And that's why they're important. They're feeling the energy of somebody in the room, and they're looking at their facial expressions, or they're looking at their process live. Mm. And maybe that's a bit of theatre for you. Maybe that's where, you know, theatre training comes in as well.
Yeah.
But there are read-throughs that have gone flat, and sometimes people can not be given as many scenes as they should be because it's a bit flat. So I would always say get involved and give it your best shot.
I know from another perspective, whether or not this is correct or not, and not in any way refuting what you've said, Stephen, I think I've known some actors that like to hold back in a read-through strategically because they don't want to give away too many elements of their performance. They don't believe in committing to a read-through because essentially that's not where the work is. Are people aware of that? Is that a strategy that you can understand, or is that something that you think, you know, just throw that out, that's not even going to work?
Oh, no, I think that's a very, very valid point. And I did preface my last point by saying people who have... you know, of a certain status or a certain status within the production already, they can throw the energy that they want to throw into a read through, and that's sort of respected. And sometimes I think there's a politeness to it where you don't want to be seen to be trying to own the room, or you don't want to step on other people's performances, especially when you haven't had those tonal conversations or the full sort of direction of where that character's going and how they interact with somebody who's been playing that character for five seasons. So I think you make a valid point too, but I would say if you've got nothing to lose, don't just read into the script. Put your head up, give it a little bit of spice, give it a little bit of character, and don't read monotonically.
There we go. That's good hot tip for any young actors listening to us. We have probably maybe a handful.
but that handful, when it comes to a read, goodness me, they're going to knock it out of the park. I mean, I've had friends of mine, I mean, this is primarily in, their experience has been primarily in comedy, which is very different to how it works on big comedy series, where this one friend of mine, it was a three-hander. It was him and two women, and they live in a flat. And this was in America somewhere. And they went in for the first read, and one of the women couldn't make it because of for some other reason. So they got somebody else to read in for the first read. They read the first read, all very funny, laughing. Ha-ha. Well, we're going to go away, do some rewrites, come back, we'll have another read. So they go away about 4 or 5 days later, come back. The girl that couldn't make it has been sacked, and the girl that read in has now got the part. Oof. So they then read it again with this new lineup. So two of the originals and a new one. They say, great, fantastic, it's getting closer to filming. They then go off. They then come back for the first rehearsal. The other woman's been sacked and somebody else has now been brought in. It was absolutely, wow. So he was the only one that remained through just three read-throughs. So it goes almost back to what you're saying is, give it a bit of oomph, give it a little bit, because you do never know. You do never know. And I've been in experiences as well where I've had a small part, as a young actor, had a small part in something, gave it a bit of welly and ended up with two more scenes.
There are no small parts, Tim. There are no small parts.
There are no small parts.
Just small actors, right?
Well, which we all know to be a lie. there are small parts. People that come in and say, you rang, or dinner's on the table.
Stephen might disagree. That was a very, very good John Tarsi impression there. You know, we wouldn't want to call his part Isaiah Moore.
Do you know what? I didn't even know that was a line. That's how English I am. I've gone straight for my line is on the telephone, or dinner is served. That's how English I am.
I wanted to ask you a couple of things about your process and what it means to be a director. And I also am kind of interested in how you got to be a director, because you've had a bit of a long and winding path to come into the career that you've had. You've, at one time or another, you were an actor, an animator, a stage manager, a production runner, an assistant director, and now finally a director. And I'm wondering, in the midst of all those jobs, was directing always the destination, or was there a time that you'd wished you'd chosen something else to do?
I knew that I wanted to direct from an early age, and as definitely from making small animations as a teenager, that was something that inspired me to want to get into behind the camera. I came from a family who worked in the theatre, and so I was around actors and acting and backstage quite a lot. So there were lots of pieces in place that inspired me, and lots of people that inspired me. But it was a long journey, and you know, I left school at 18 and had 2 years off before doing a degree, and was running around making tea for 2 years, and then did a degree in film and television, got a graduation film, thought I would come out of university and make films and be a director, and didn't, and was part of the, you know, several assistant directing teams. There was a third assistant director, then a second assistant director, then a first assistant director for about 10 years. And I got involved in a wonderful career that took me around the world on some really interesting movies, and learned from some really, really great directors, you know, Gillis McKinnon, Tom Hooper, David Yates. You know, one of the last things I first AD'd was State of Play, which David Yates directed, which was a phenomenal sort of BAFTA award-winning TV thriller. And he inspired me to, hey, get out there, you know, start directing. And I started getting some days where I could be the second unit director on various things, and that gave me a reel, and then the BBC gave me a job as a director on a children's TV drama, and I made steps onwards from there. And you know, everybody has mentors and supporters in their lives, and David Yates was one of those people. And I 2 years after I started directing, he got the Harry Potter job and wanted to bring his own team in, and I had just done a load of sort of effects work as a director,
right,
and I was in the right place at the right time and became his second unit director on the last four Potters and the Fantastic Beasts, which is a job that I still do. I still go back and forth between a television directing career and supporting him as his second unit director on various movies. I did think I'd be directing at about 29 years old, and it ended up at about 37 years old. But the assistant directing thing was good because you're able to get close to how productions work. You get close to the cast, you get close to storytelling techniques.
Mm-hmm. So you use that time to really learn and hone your skills. I mean, it sounds like you started off as the coffee boy or the tea boy, to use the English parlance, and then worked your way up from there as a runner. And then through persistence, you eventually got the break that you wanted to be a director. I wanted to know what you thought are the qualities of a good director, and how did you learn them? You mentioned you had a few mentors. What about them made them a good director? I mean, I have my own ideas what makes a good director. Tim, you probably have yours. Probably one that always says you're great, you're doing really good work.
They're the best ones. Yeah. They're comfortably the best ones. Well, for me, a really good director would be someone who allows you space, mm-hmm. which is always difficult on a big production. And one of the things that I felt that you did, Stephen, was allow that space. There's a structure, but there is space within it to create and to breathe as a character and to kind of have ideas.
Yeah, it brings us onto the earlier thread. So we've had the read through, we've rehearsed, and then we've had this wonderful rehearsal. We had about 40 minutes, didn't we, David, in the rehearsal room to do this wonderful drinking game scene, and you could just tell that it was going to be fun. And what we worked out there was the physical rules of the game. And I had an idea, because I only had 120 extras or whatever. That's right. A large number of people, and it was great. But I needed to create a sort of naughty corner of the wedding. Mm-hmm. This is not where everybody's dancing. This is a slightly more rough and ready area. So I asked the art department for three carts, and I sort of created a triangle of carts. So I created my own little arena and knew that the action that we'd rehearsed would fit in that arena. And then we could dress it with the supporting artists, and they could be on different levels, and it could be quite, you know, gladiatorial almost. And that was the vision that the rehearsal gave me. And then you get to the set. So you have this vision. So every day, if you're prepared as a director, you have to have a plan that will get you, with nobody else's input, you have to have a plan that will get you through the day. That's your sort of parachute. That's your safety. But what you do want is that journey to be corrupted, to take a different turn by everybody else's creativity.
Oh, I definitely tried to corrupt your vision there a couple of times. If I remember correctly, I did balk at some of your suggestions. I think for me, it was a little tricky for me. I don't think I had the same sense of excitement going into it, because I thought, to be honest, it was a bit of a character challenge for me. There were many reasons why I thought maybe John Gray, in the very first instance, why is he at the wedding? He's on the book. Those things that you usually are there for you in the script, or in the book, sorry, Darren's book, to kind of pad out your research. There was no justification there, and I like that kind of justification. And then to sort of be fraternizing with the rabble and all that kind of stuff, I had my own, as an actor, sense of how I wanted it to work, and my excitement there was not synergistic with yours, because obviously I had my own ideas. And I think I remember at one point, one disagreement we had, or one point of discussion, let's be diplomatic, we didn't get into any fights or anything. I remember we had a great time. But it was whether or not John Gray was going to drink out of the thing and whether he would allow John Quincy Myers to actually tip it in his mouth, to which I wasn't really sure, because to maintain the integrity of the character, maintain his high status, that was something I really challenged you on. And you must be getting that at all points of the day, people having differing opinions about how to do things. You use this term ringmaster. And so I wanted to see if you could unpack that a bit. How much power are you actually of ownership of your vision do you actually have? And how open are you to the fluidity and the spontaneity of filmmaking?
Yeah, no, I think that's a, you know, having a plan that will get you through the day, if nothing else goes wrong, is a starting point. But it's also wanting to create a safe space, a creative space for everybody to have a creative involvement. And there's nothing better than looking forward to cast members coming on set going, well, I can't wait to see what's in the head about this, because you probably haven't rehearsed it. You never have time to rehearse, you know, much stuff on a TV show of this sort of schedule.
Or some we don't even know what we're supposed to do in the scene. I don't know if you agree with me, Tim. We defer a lot of our responsibility to a director to come up with our choices. I think as you get better and more confident in your craft and more confident in your character, you start to make those choices and you can start having a bit more of an active disagreement or discussion with the director. But I think sometimes actors like to defer responsibility to the director to tell them what to do.
Yeah, I mean, part of the process of pre-production is to go through back and forth to the locations or to the sets, work out a way that the scene will work, and your key moments, you know, that key moment of Claire looking out of the window in silhouette, you know, even if it's not written, that's something you write in your script and going, that's a really good image. I need to sell that to Katrina when she comes onto the set. And maybe it's a, you know, it's a number of bullet points without being over prescriptive on a performance, but it's a number of, God, this, you know, we're here today at this time because the sun's going to set over there, and we're shooting the scene this way for the beautiful backlight and silhouette, and these are the choices I've had to make in advance, and they're all good, wonderful, creative choices, and then we can fill in the detail with performance beats and interpretation and personality and character beats. So, you know, every day you have to almost sell a vision to a cast, and create an atmosphere where you're never bullying a performance or bullying a methodology to a scene. Where you're finding it together. But for me, that you have to be honest. The moment you're not honest to very, very intelligent, well-read cast members, you can get yourself into trouble. And you say, look, I'm here. That's going to be beautiful. That's a key image to the scene. You know, and
I suppose that requires a bit of code switching and being able to speak different languages. Do you find it, you know, you're more adept at speaking the language of different departments? Like, is it easier to talk to the camera department or is it easier to talk to actors? Like, so I've known that some directors are very kind of nervous about talking to actors because, I don't know, sometimes we can be a bit precious. I don't know about you, Tim. I can be a bit precious about my performance sometimes. I remember one time when I was a young actor, there was one particular scene that was written. I was in the third season. I was quite attached to my character, and the script asked for my character to break down and cry. And I was just, I'd come to a point with this character that I was just so tired of playing that kind of that beat, and I didn't agree with it in the script. And I was trying to fight I was a bit of a brat to the director, the writer, and I said, it needs to be rewritten because this is just not right. And I was trying to recruit the director to my point of view, and he didn't bite, which actually taught me a very good lesson. His name is Ian Barry. He's a very experienced director. He pushed back. And when I said to him, my character's not going to do that, he said, well, think about this. Your character can do anything. Your character can literally do anything. And you're right now putting the parameters on what he can and can't do. And so he had to sell to me that this scene is, and at the end of the day, I had to play the scene as written. I learned to respect that relationship. He agreed with me that it probably wasn't the right thing for the character, but at the end of the day, he had to make the captain's call. And he also had a vision of how the entire episode had to work. And it really taught me to open up my mind to possibility and also how to defer to a hierarchy and how director obviously has to, you know, make those kind of calls all the time, be the umpire.
Yeah, well, because obviously I do a lot of comedy, and comedy is so subjective. It's sometimes what you find funny, other people don't find funny. Or there are certain rhythms within a scene that don't work. I can remember having a very grown-up conversation with Harry Enfield once about when my trousers should fall down. And you do get to a point when you're a man of a certain age and you kind of think, I really shouldn't be sat here discussing, well, is it funnier to walk straight in and my trousers fall down? Or shall it be the tension of the scene of his trousers are going to fall down, but when? And then when you leave, your trousers fall down. We had at least a 20-minute, half-an-hour discussion on that. But that was very interesting then to kind of have the third party look at the scope. Because as an actor, you see, sometimes you see it in isolation. You kind of see your bit as this is my bit and we're going to do this bit. Whereas the director has the view of the whole piece, the feel of the whole piece, how the whole piece is going to sound, how the mood, the feel and everything about it. So I think on those occasions that one does have to defer. But I was going to ask you, Stephen, you have ideas, you have these little totems throughout a scene that you're making, kind of, we'll hit this, this is a good image, this is a good moment, and this is a good moment. Have there been times where that has changed, where actually you've gone, do you know what, that's actually a better idea, we should do that?
Oh, all the time, from the way that Jocasta grabbed hold of Roger's hand at Jocasta's tent. You know, it's not in the script. But it's a fundamentally key moment within that scene. It's her saying, "No, listen to me. I'm the boss." And it's just beautiful little things like that. Going back to the drinking game, David and I, did have a moment where I was wrongly trying to encourage David to have drunken a little bit more than he thought his character would have, or at least showing it. And the enigmatic way in which David resolved that conversation and played the very straight way in which Lord John makes his Shakespeare declaration and gets the humour of it, was a way in which we could agree, and I think it worked beautifully. And that's me going, well, you know, we're in series five of this, and you've been around for most of those series, and
I think it comes down to trust, doesn't it? You want to trust that you both have invested in this thing in equal measure, and you both have an understanding of the character. I think sometimes actors get a little bit anxious that the director doesn't understand your character as well as you do, or no one understands the character as well as you. Get very possessive. So I think you have to have a degree of trust and just being able to open up those possibilities, like I said, that the way that you see things, as Tim also said, can be a bit myopic. And what we really all want to know, Tim, is did you come in with your pants up or down?
Thank you for bringing it back to this. We actually thought it was funnier to have the tension of the scene, knowing it's going to happen, is you don't give away the joke too early. You hold back. So the audience know. It's like with a catchphrase. It's like a classic catchphrase of "I don't believe it" or something like that. You know it's coming. You know the character's going to say it, but it's how and when they say it is half the enjoyment. That particular character of "I don't believe it," you kind of think, is he going to say it to this or is he? But you know it's coming. But it's all to do with the timing and where you place it and how you build it.
I'm stuck, Tim. I have this image of you with your pants down, and I can't. Everything you just said has just gone over my head.
There's another really good example in the drinking game.
Oh, yes.
So the way in which the drinking game is cut is that it starts in the episode with Paul Donnelly, who plays Ronnie Sinclair, walking out. So it's the end of the scene first. He walks out and John Quincy Myers says, "Oh, my mouth's dry. Who's next?" And he walks out and Ronnie says, "I sleep the shit. I sleep the shit."
That wasn't in the script.
That was not in the script. And there's a technique that I learned from Werner Herzog.
Clang.
Ooh, Werner Herzog. Clang.
who says to aspiring directors, whenever you think you're going to say cut, say it 5 seconds later at least. And this can be incredibly annoying to some cast members, but you can get a system where people know that you're not going to say cut immediately, and some people can just play to the camera and make a silly face, but other people will go to us strange place. And the whole Ronnie Sinclair ad lib that wasn't in the script that now heads the start of that scene, they play the end of the scene first in the cut, was me not saying cut and going, "Well, I love this energy. What's going to happen now?" And Kyle Reese keeps going as John Quincy Myers and going, "Right, Ronnie Sinclair, you're next." And Paul Donnelly.
So we really owe our directing credit here to Werner Herzog, which I'm very happy about. 5 seconds after you cut. I really wanted to get my impression in there, Steve.
It was good. I could feel the energy of, I could do my Herzog at last.
I'm sorry.
Someone's asked for my Herzog.
I was really listening. And I also wanted, there's something else I've been really wanting to ask you, Stephen, is this question of auteurship, or the auteur theory. It's something that we all often attribute to film directors, but I'm wondering how much it's applicable to a TV director, because, you know, like when we think of directors, I think it's a common misconception amongst people who don't really understand TV or just don't understand the job and function of director. They think, "Oh, director, I know someone like Kubrick. He loves wide lenses and classical music, and or Terrence Malick, and he gets obsessed with a flower petal or something like that." I was wondering what kind of ownership you feel over the episodes you direct. I mean, so much of it seems to be taken away from you by the showrunner or the millions of decisions that you've had to make have been made for you before the cameras even started rolling.
Yeah. It is a huge part of the process is to learn to deal with what your responsibilities are and what voice you have. And it's to know the voice that you have and know how to use it. And every decision you make on set hopefully expresses part of your personality and is all about being one of the authors on a show like this. You are not the author. I mean, I started on block one of series five of Outlander, and the big house is already built. Nobody's talked to me about what the big house looks like or...
You didn't even cast me. You may not have chosen me as Lord John. You might have chosen Tim. I think it's all evidenced by his reading. He's clearly the better choice.
Self-evident. It's self-evident from that read.
So it's a really good point. I don't think I'd be doing it if I didn't feel that I was expressing myself. But at the same time, I know that I'm a company player. Without doubt, I'm a company player, and I shoot a lot of footage, and I shoot quite a lot of angles because I know on these jobs they go into post-production, and there's a lot of re-engineering of scenes and orders and timelines, and if you can provide them with the building blocks to do what they need to do to keep the story running in the direction they want to, then that's part of your job. And none of us should feel bad about that. I've been in an edit suite, and I've heard screams from other edit suites, on various shows when they haven't got the footage to change the dialogue or get out of the scene quicker or adjust a performance. And on these shows, you need all of those things with, you know, without a doubt.
I was just thinking it was very similar to the job of an actor. I mean, we don't have any control over the edit. A lot of the time, what we get out of the creative process is just going in there with the best intent to put forth as many choices as possible. But no, at the end of the day, we are the servant of a master, and that person will then have their input onto the show, which is the editor. And so I am very fascinated about what you're talking about with the editing process, and particularly as it relates to a director, because, you know, you probably never want an actor in the editing studio. I know if the editing suite, I know if I had the cut, the final cut, it'd probably be just the Lord John show. And if Tim had it, it'd probably be the Tryon show.
Absolutely. It'd be walking past in every scene, whether or not it was even there. It'd already gone to New York and then come back. And
ask him for reshoot as well, you know, ask him for all the rewrites.
Let's go back to the wedding night. So the wedding night, I identified that in pre-production and I said, hey, look, there's so much going on here. We could have a rewrite and we could start cutting between all of the three couple stories, the drinking game, the dancing game, the other people at the party. And I suggested that in pre-production, and they said, no, keep it as it is. But hey, if you can get us the footage to get us in and out of there, you know, we could see that might be a way to go. And in post-production on Outlander, which is similar to very many other American shows, I, as a director, I finish the shoot, I go straight into 5 days of post-production per episode. So I only have 5 days to deliver a director's cut. And that director's cut is where you show your intentions.
In a perfect world, how many days would you want in an edit suite?
Well, there are different models of building a show. This American model, where you only have 5 days, gets you onto another job very quickly. On Poldark, you're much more the sort of in charge of post-production director. And I had between 12 and 16 weeks of post-production where you're responsible to do all the ADR, all the music, all the effects, and you're there right the way through to virtually delivery. But that can take almost a year of your life with the pre-production and the shooting of it. And that's it's a lovely process. It's fantastic. But there's something here where you shoot, you edit, and you move on. But those 5 days are difficult to deliver everything that you wanted to deliver. You deliver a series of ideas about your intentions and about how things could be restructured, or, you know, playing to what you see the positives are. And with regards to episode one of series five of Outlander, the assembly that I received on my first day of the edit was 1 hour and 29 minutes long.
Wow.
So a movie, basically a movie.
Yeah. So in my 5 days, I had to get the scenes working in a certain way, and I had to cut a load of stuff, but I only delivered my director's cut at 1 hour 12, 1 hour 13, and I hinted at the intercutting of all the love stories.
Mm-hmm.
But then it went off to LA and to the showrunner and the post-production facility in LA, and they jumped on that, and they looked at the tone of episode one, and right in the middle of the wedding night, there was a much darker, longer scene between Roger and Brianna in their hut before they make love, taking Brianna to a much darker place where it was much difficult to get her back from. So a lot of that was cut, and it was kept lighter. And I think for the good of the episode, because she's got such a long journey to go with all of that, and she was, you know, it was hard to oscillate between getting married and suffering huge PTSD all in one night, and then getting alone with her husband, and then suffering again, and then getting into bed, and I thought it was a, you know, what they delivered from LA and what the showrunner delivered was a great celebration of the wedding with right. hints of those bits of darkness. Yeah. But it was a much more complicated episode on the page.
Yeah, and I'd be interested. I mean, there's obviously some compromises you've had to make for Brianna's storyline, but at the end of the day, it's about the episode in its entirety, and things like you're talking about tone and momentum, which I'm very much aware of, and probably the reason why all my stuff got cut, and I'm not mad about it. I'm not bitter.
Barely brought it up at all.
tone is an interesting word, because what you on Outlander and other American shows, you arrive, you've read the script for a day, you've made a load of notes, you have a page turn with all the departments where you go, right, we've got 5 weeks ahead of us, and I'm looking at, this is really interesting. Oh, I'd like to know how that works. Can we design that? I need four of those. I need 40 of those soldiers. Just as for starters, that's on day two of your prep. And then after that page turn with the crew, you go into the showrunner's office and you sit down with the showrunner and the producer writer who's going to be on set with you. And maybe you're on a call to LA as well. And you have a pre-tone meeting. And a pre-tone meeting is them commissioning you to go, right, we've all read the script. This is what we want you to focus on. Go and find that. That's going to be tricky. Report back to us in a couple of days about how that's going to work. And do you think that'll work? We love the way these two actors are working together. That's a really tricky scene, so you know, make sure you get some rehearsal time for that. And it's a sort of, here you go, my son. You got 5 weeks, sort it out. And you're given 4 or 5 weeks of pre-production, and you're developing the script with them all the time, and then you come back after the read-through, and you come back, and then you have the tone meeting. Yeah. My last tone meeting on episodes 7 and 8 started at midday, and we were still on the phone to LA at midnight. It was proper midnight pizzas. And that tone meeting, just before you start shooting, is you saying, you pitching your vision with everything that you've discussed with them, saying, this is how it's going to look. They're going to go from A to B to C. We're going to need some establishers there. This scene still isn't working. I've rehearsed this. I've put a bed in the rehearsal room and we've rehearsed it on the bed. And can we have a rewrite? They will also be pitching in to you as the director any cast members' notes or anything they think is applicable. They're very discreet, but they will say, oh, we've had some notes in from here, and we're looking at these 15 pages of David Berry's notes.
Wow. 15 pages. Probably more like 20. Come on.
but we're
very detailed and discreet.
Yeah. You know, they declare to you certain things and they say, we're still looking at that. And I say, can we rewrite that? And they say, no. Okay, can we shuffle that around? And what if this happened and what if that happened? And then literally 24 hours later, you're on the floor directing. You know, one of the difficult parts of that commission is it is an unwritten rule that certain things that you've agreed in that meeting, certain key things for the producers and the creators of the show, some of the key things you sort of sign in that meeting is stuff that you will need to fight for on set with the writer producer who's on set. And so, you know, sometimes you are fighting for stuff that you have to have been told, you know, stuff that is important to other people, the stuff that's not naturally important to you. You know, the showrunner director relationship is a key thing, and it's a relationship. You know, I think one of the skills of directing is there are so many people that are asking you questions and wanting answers from you, and you wanting answers from them. You have to make relationships work. And Matthew B. Roberts, I adore, and you know, he's there with such a passionate, connected vision to the series, and you know, he has to answer to so many people. He has to answer to the network, to the creator, to the studio, to the cast.
Well, I think we all have to have a love for this, and especially the man who's captaining it. I think no one would be in this if they didn't love it, and I think that love translates onto the screen, and of course the fan base. And I think the fans are going to really benefit from your insights today, Stephen. And I want, for one, hope that my parents have benefited from this discussion and now understand what a director is, because until very recently they've been trying to get me to course correct my career, telling me that I have to be a director because the director is the guy that gets to make all the shots, drives the Mercedes-Benz, and gets the big bucks. So Mum and Dad, please understand.
None of those things.
Maybe I'm not doing so bad. It's okay if I'm an actor. I don't know if they ever accept that.
Yes, but, absolutely. Well, look, Stephen, thank you so much. I can certainly say that from the episodes that we did together, also I think you mentioned episodes 7 and 8, were just such a joy to work on. Big scale episodes as well, in order to kind of get the intimacies and emotion in that, and that's testament to you as a director having to kind of orchestrate these enormous palettes.
Absolutely.
Of people and opinions and all of this to create those episodes. So certainly from my point of view, I would say, you know, thank you for such an enjoyable experience doing those incredible scenes.
The season finale, you got the opener, and you got the big scene with Tim Downey. I mean, these are the things that any director wants.
Exactly.
Wants. And
that's the Holy Trinity right there. Openers, enders, Downey. You know, perfect.
Very fond memories, and thank you very much.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Stephen, thank you so much for your time and for coming on our show this evening. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm now going to leave it, by the way, 5 seconds at least before shouting cuts.
Very, very good.
Hello and welcome to Listener Mail, a part of the show where we have thumbed through our inbox and seen some tasty tidbits that you've left us. We have a wonderful one here. Yeah, yes, we have a wonderful one here from Steve in Sydney, your neck of the woods.
Oh, hi,
he
Steve.
Would like to know.
G'day.
Hi, Steve. G'day. Mm-hmm. He would like to know what aquatic mammal we would be. Well, that's very interesting, Steve. I myself would be, I think, the manatee, the sea cow, as they say, trawling the ocean depths, just kind of grubbing along with my nose. I think that'd be fabulous. And very good-natured as well.
How funny, Tim. I would have to say the same thing, although we would call it the dugong here. But, we like to pick funny names for our cities and our creatures. So thank you, Steve, from, it says, Sydney Aquatic Centre. Thank you very much for that question.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldon or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier. So.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Hold up. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.